I'm opening the Senate Committee on Consumer Protection and Public Affairs for today, March 19th, 2009. Two of our senators are ill today. Senator Burdick and Senator Rosenbaum are out, and so we're going to go ahead with, the three of us. Hopefully, Senator Girod will be back shortly. And I'm going to actually reverse the order from what's on the agenda to accommodate schedules and timing and start with a public hearing on Senate Bill 771. And, Lori, if you will please give us a summary of Senate Bill 771.
I'd be happy to. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 771 amends certain provisions for termination of tenancy. It allows for a 30-day no-cause notice of termination by a tenant and a month-to-month tenancy. Allows for a 30-day no-cause notice of termination by the landlord within the first year of a month-to-month tenancy, and then allows for a 60-day no-cause notice by the landlord after a first year of month-to-month. Specifies procedures for terminating the month-to-month tenancy, specifies procedures for terminating fixed-term tenancy of at least 1 year, and allows but does not require the statement of reason for termination in the notice. Allows temporary occupancy agreement and specifies the parties who may be subject to that agreement. It delineates procedures and parameters for the temporary occupancy agreement. It delineates the procedures for disposition of personal property of a deceased tenant. It mandates that the landlord provide the tenant with a written list of charges, prohibits the landlord from charging a fee or deposit for an assistance animal. It specifies procedures and allowable charges related to the tenant damage or abandonment of rental housing. We do have a no revenue impact and no fiscal impact on the bill as introduced, and that's it.
Thank you, Lori. And I want to note that on the bill, you'll see that this is at the request of the General Landlord-Tenant Coalition. And we have two people from that group here today, John Van Landingham and Norton, I hope I say it right, Cabell?
Cabell.
Was close. Welcome. And I also want to note, and I'm sure the witnesses will explain this, that there will be an amendment to this bill. A Dash 1 amendment is still at Legislative Council, so perhaps they will explain that today, but we do not have the amendment as of this time. Welcome.
So, Madam Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Norton Cabell. I'm the Legislative Director of Oregon Rental Housing Association, a statewide landlord trade group that represents about 5,000 landlords around the state. Senate Bill 771, as the Chair indicated, is the work of the General Landlord Tenant Coalition, a group that's been operating for about a quarter of a century. The goal of the coalition is to propose legislation that will, to be blunt, protect good tenants from bad landlords and good landlords from bad tenants. While everybody is welcome to participate in the coalition, the major players are, on the landlord side, Metro Multifamily Housing Association, Multifamily Housing Council of Oregon, and the Oregon Rental Housing Association. And on the tenant side, the Community Alliance of Tenants, the Oregon Law Center, and Lane County Legal Aid and Advocacy Center. Other groups and individuals also participate, for example, the Association of Oregon Housing Authorities and the Institute of Real Estate Managers. We also specifically invite others when a subject under consideration might affect them. One reason we are successful is that anyone is welcome to attend and participate, though it is not for the faint of heart. Before each session, the coalition meets for many months, once for over a year, negotiating issues of interest to one side or the other. Big issues that we've worked on over the last several years include domestic violence, mold, parking and towing, and retaliation. Discussion around a particular subject usually begins with a description of the problem, usually caused by a bad tenant or a bad landlord. If the group agrees a problem exists, we then move to possible solutions. Some are more workable than others, and most come with a cost, a burden to one side or the other. We then discuss and negotiate ways to mitigate or balance the cost. Then on to the next subject. Our omnibus bill always consists of several issues. Most of those benefit one side more than the other. In the end, when both sides agree that the trade-offs and the total package are worth it, we have a coalition omnibus bill. Getting both sides to work together has obvious benefits for the legislature. The coalition spends much more time on a given issue than a legislative committee could, and we also make sure that the legitimate concerns of each side and other affected parties are heard and addressed. So I thank you for your time, and on behalf of the landlord side of the coalition anyway, I encourage you and ask you to support Senate Bill 771.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Bonamici, members of the committee. My name is John Van Landingham. I work as a Blaine County legal aid lawyer and have done that for almost 30 years. And I am on the tenant side of this coalition. Norton's described the coalition a little bit. My written handout describes it some more. We did meet 18 times to produce Senate Bill 771. Unlike a lot of bill requests, we actually give legislative counsel exactly what we want, word for word, line by line. We don't get what we want. you're familiar with that part. So the amendments...
No comment.
no comment. So we were emailing last night about this very subject. So the amendments are not huge, but they are in the sense of me saying to Harrison Conley, so why'd you take out that word? That word's important. And it's because that's how we negotiate the things. And each word means something to landlords or tenants. And it's all part of this one act, Chapter 90, the Landlord-Tenant Act. And we've been doing this a long time. We think we know the act pretty well. And we know that it already says X over here, and it ought to say X over there. And so we get to be a little bit possessive about it. I've given you a three-page handout that runs through the significance of the amendments, or the whole bill. I don't know that I would... Lori already described it. I can go into it in greater detail if you want. But I think the one thing I do want to note for sure, unless you have questions, is that on the abandoned property of dead tenant issue, there's not probably a better way to say that. It's a tenant who abandoned in the sense the tenant died and had no roommates. Tenant who lives alone. So there's nobody else to claim the property. The problem for landlords is that we have an abandoned property process. It's very complicated. It's 5 pages long in Oregon revised statutes, but it doesn't address abandoned stuff. It does address, because of a dead tenant, it does address abandoned manufactured homes, but not the stuff inside the home or in an apartment. And that's an issue for landlords. One of the 4 issues we've addressed in the bill is trying to address that for landlords. Division of state lands has a concern. Unclaimed estates go to DSL, I think, for the Common School Fund. Obviously, there's a need to grab... obviously, there's a need to maximize revenues. DSL has... We've been talking with DSL. We think we can work something out so that we're happy, and we'll include that in the amendments when they're ready. I'd be glad to go into greater detail, but I'll bet you don't need that or want that.
Thank you very much. And you already answered my question. Do you have any questions, Senator Girard?
Madam Chair, is to compliment the fact that you two come from different extremes in the issue and that you can work together to come up with a bill. I'm sure makes it a lot easier on us. And so I was just thanking you for bringing this forward.
Thank you, Senator Girard. We actually grew up in Virginia, although we didn't know this. together, and he's from the aristocratic side, so I get the advantage of that in our negotiations.
Any questions, Senator George?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my comment is if DSL is being a problem, maybe I'll just introduce an amendment that you guys just back up and put the stuff on the front steps of DSL. I'll take care of the problem from there.
So. That's been an approach that landlords have wanted to take tenants for many, many years, but probably not allowed.
Thank you. And I want to echo the comments made by Senator Girard about how much we appreciate your willingness to get together. And 18 times really shows your dedication to getting things worked out. And I guess I must say that if everybody did this, we might be put out of a job. Thank you very much. And we look forward to working with you on the Dash 1 amendments.
So, Senator Bonamici, Lori indicated that you had a question, and maybe should put it on the record, the question about whether there was a conflict between the amendment regarding assistance animals.
Right.
And there's the Boley bill.
Thank you. Senate bill, I think we have that resolved, but let's put it on the record. Senate bill 875 prohibits a person from charging a fee or deposit for an assistance animal in rental housing. And Lori, my very capable committee administrator, pointed out that on page 22 in section, I believe it is 12 of Senate Bill, section 11 or section 12? Section 12 of Senate Bill 771 contains similar but not identical provisions. And so if you want to comment on that.
Senator Bonamici, we are in communication with Boley, and in fact, Sybil Hebb, who works with our coalition, also has been working with Boley on a number of those bills. and as Norton. And what we're both trying to do is describe what is accepted federal law. Our desire to put something in Chapter 90 is because Chapter 90 is intended for landlords and tenants, especially landlords, who most of whom don't use lawyers. It's meant to be a guide for them. And we write it. We've written about half of it at this point, to be used by lay people. So we want to have something in Chapter 90 that says clearly to landlords, you can't charge a fee for an assistance or a deposit for an assistance.
This is very important. I do a lot of teaching of landlords, and I keep hearing, oh, it's okay to charge a fee for a companion animal, assistance animal, whatever. And I say, no, there's federal law that says there isn't. But putting it in Chapter 90, they understand that really is the rules, and so it's important that it be there.
Thank you. Thank you for that clarification. And we look forward to working with you when we get the amendments. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 771 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 731. And, Lori, if you want to explain this bill, and I will make a comment that we did have an informational hearing on this issue before we actually had the bill. And so now we have the bill, and Lori will briefly describe it, and then we'll start our public hearing. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 731 provides that for the lesser of $2,500 or the total amount in a debtor's accounts, provides that that is exempt from garnishment if those exempt payments were made by direct deposit or electronic transfer within 45 days before the writ of garnishment was delivered. It delineates the funds that were exempt from garnishment. It maintains the exemption of all deposited federally exempt funds if the funds are reasonably identifiable. It specifies first in, first out as the accounting method to be used when identifying the exempt funds, and it raises the wildcard exemption from $400 to $1,000. It prohibits a financial institution from charging a processing fee if the debtor's deposited funds are not subject to garnishment.
Thank you very much. And we did receive some things in writing that I want to make sure are included on the record. We have a statement from the Oregon War Veterans Association dated with today's date in support of Senate Bill 731. We have a letter dated March 18th, 2009 from Larry Peek of Coquille in support, and also a letter from Linda M. Smith dated March 18th, 2009 in support, and that is from the Douglas Consumer Credit Counseling in Roseburg. If the first panel we'll have is Jim Kaur and Sybil Hebb, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center in support of Senate Bill 731 today. Appreciate the time that the committee has spent considering this issue, both at the informational hearing and today. This is one of the priority issues for the Oregon Law Center. As you know, we represent low-income people across the state of Oregon, and preservation of low-income people's access to subsistence-level income, especially during these times of economic crisis, is one of our highest priorities. Senate Bill 731 addresses a very important issue. I won't repeat the testimony that was put on the record last week, but I will just briefly summarize to say that the bottom line is that there are public benefits that have been determined long ago by state and federal law to be exempt from collection. And the purpose behind those exemptions, the policy piece behind those exemptions, is a recognition of the fact that there are vulnerable people who need assistance, and the state, in many circumstances, provides that assistance for people, and that's intended to help them meet their basic needs. It's not meant to be taken away from them without warning through a garnishment and distributed to creditors. We do understand and acknowledge that there are people who are recipients of public benefits who have judgments that are valid and legitimate judgments against them, but the purpose of the public benefit safety net is to help those people, those vulnerable people, maintain their lives, take care of their kids, and hopefully get back on their feet so that they can be, in the future, productive members of society. Our current garnishment and claim of exemption procedures in Oregon are contrary to the public purpose behind the exemption laws, the state and federal exemption laws. And as we described last week, what happens right now when a collection is presented or a garnishment is presented to a bank takes the money from the account, even though they may have reason to know from looking at the deposit records that there are exempt funds being direct deposited into that account. The bank, in response to the garnishment, takes the money and turns it over to the creditor. And our current claim of exemption process puts the burden on the debtor, the vulnerable person receiving the exempt benefits, to go to court, have the wherewithal to understand what the legal proceedings are that are available to them, and without any money or without any access to funds during that time because they have been taken from the account, find a means of obtaining legal assistance and getting to the courthouse and going through that process, which can take weeks and sometimes even months before the monies are returned. And even when they are returned, they are significantly diminished because of the charges of overdraft fees, garnishment fees, and bounced check fees that have taken place during the time that the deprivation of funds existed. And so even if they're able to successfully go through that process, they are significantly reduced in the funds that should have been exempt from collection in the first place. You may remember the story of the Vietnam veteran I shared last week. He intended to be here today to testify, but told me last weekend on Sunday that he thought he would be unable to make it. He is still struggling without the benefit of his funds, which were garnished from his account on the 2nd of February. So today, on the 19th of March, they are not yet back in his hands. He is struggling to keep his lights on. He's working with PG&E to try to negotiate with them. He's finally managed to work out an agreement with the phone company not to cut his phone service off, but he's concerned about the natural gas bill, and he's also concerned about his mortgage, and he's facing foreclosure potentially. So he's suffering a significant amount from the fact that our current system is not set up to work well or effectively to protect these public benefits, these exempt funds. So the solution that we have proposed in Senate Bill 731 is simple and clear, and it's easy to implement, and it provides substantial protection to vulnerable people. I wanted to just briefly outline the basics of the bill and of our proposal, and then Mr. Cora will talk about some of the details about how our proposal works and how it contrasts with the current law. The solution that we propose is one that's modeled after a procedure that's put into place in five different states. It provides that where there are direct deposit exempt funds that are reasonably identifiable coming into a bank account, and the bank has reason to know that and can reasonably identify that, then those bank accounts will be entitled to a certain minimum level of protection, beyond which, below which, they cannot be garnished. Our proposal in the bill was that the minimum level of protection would be $2,500. The reason that we picked that number is that the maximum Social Security benefit, which is an exempt benefit of great importance to many elderly Americans, is $2,400 roughly a month. And so we picked that number. We're negotiable on that number, and certainly there have been some concerns expressed from collectors that they would like to see that number go down, and we're open to that discussion. The basic concept is that we want to make sure that we are not reducing people's funds to zero without any warning, such that they are unable to take care of their basic minimum needs and putting them in a position in which they are going to be incurring many, many dollars in overdraft fees and other fines. The client that I spoke with last week has at this point incurred $500 of overdraft fines out of his exempt funds. Our proposal is something that will help people meet their basic minimum needs. It will avoid the charging of overdraft fees and fines because it will maintain money in the account, and it's easy for banks to administer because the example or the assessment that they have to go through under our proposal would only be twofold. Number one, are there direct deposits coming into this account that are exempt from collection, and can I tell that reasonably? And number two, what's the minimum level of money in the account? Is it above or below the minimum level of protection that we establish? So it's easy for banks to administer. And for that reason, we believe it offers a significant advantage over some of the other proposals that have been put forward. I want to talk briefly about the issue of commingled funds. This came up in our discussion last week, and the question was raised whether or not our proposal would protect only exempt funds or whether it would also offer protection to some funds that might not be exempt. And the answer is that it would offer protection to some commingled funds. And I want to explain how that might work and why I think that's a valid public policy choice that this committee can make, and that we hope the committee will make. People receiving direct deposit exempt funds are a vulnerable class of people. They're veterans, disabled people, elderly people, people receiving unemployment insurance because they've recently been laid off. These are people who are in dire times and relying on a safety net. If we protect a basic minimum level of money in the account, we're ensuring that we're not putting them further in the hole and cycling down into this sort of spiral where they can't meet their needs and they're unable to get back and up and on their feet, which is the purpose of the public benefit and the safety net in the first place. So the principle or the policy behind protecting a minimum level is that we want to help ensure that the safety net is there for this class of people. The practical reality is that most people who receive public benefits do not have access to a great amount of extra other funds. So while there may be commingled funds in a person's bank account, a check from their mother, some assistance from a neighbor, other. And sometimes it's even just a basic minimum level of earning if you have a job every other Saturday that you end up having money for. But these are people who have significant either disabilities or disadvantages because of age who are unemployed. And so there aren't a lot of other funds that are likely to be commingled in these accounts. And we think that it's an appropriate public policy decision for the committee to make to establish a minimum number. I guess the other advantage to the proposal that we have put forward is that because it's so easy and simple, it's something that creditors understand, banks understand, and debtors understand. And what we find right now under the current system is that there's a great deal of confusion as to what's protected, what's not protected, how that policy, how the implementation of the current law will work, and what a debtor's rights are when they're seeking to challenge a collection. So, our proposal has many advantages, we feel, and I guess I want to contrast it just briefly to a proposal that I understand the banks have put forward, which is to have their officers engage in a very detailed analysis and accounting of funds before they determine what monies will be protected. And essentially, I think, under the bank's proposal, they're suggesting that the bank teller or whoever at the bank is responsible for doing the analysis under their proposal take the place of what is currently the judge's responsibility in a normal claim of exemption procedure. So under the bank's proposal, as I understand it, the teller or whoever at the bank is assigned with this responsibility would be doing a thorough analysis and applying a fairly complicated system of accounting. We currently ask our judges to do that through the claim of exemption process, and we're more comfortable with leaving that level of analysis at that in that department. I want to just briefly address two other provisions of the bill. Senate Bill 731 clarifies what the accounting principles are that should be applicable to claim of exemption hearings. Under our proposal, if there are funds in an account that are over and above the basic minimum level of protection, then if some of those funds were still exempt because they are veterans benefits, for example, or Social Security, then the bank account holder could still go through the claim of exemption process that exists under current law and ask the judge to take a closer look at what those funds were. Right now, there's no codified standard by which the judge should make a determination as to which monies are exempt and which monies are not. Our bill proposes that the first in and first out method of accounting be used in those hearings. We believe that's the common sense method, and we believe it's the most widely adopted method, but it would be good for, I think, everyone if we had a consistently used method and if that were identifiable and codified in the statute. We also have proposed that the current wild card exemption, I don't know where that name came from, but that's in fact what it's called, be adjusted for inflation. And what I'm talking about is a particular section of the statute that allows a person in a claim of exemption hearing to claim $400 under current law dollars in exempt funds if they're not otherwise entitled to any exemption. That exemption was passed in 1981. It has not been adjusted since then, and $1,000 is basically an inflation adjustment to that number. If we take $400 in 1981 dollars and adjust that, I think it's 982. I can't remember what the exact number is, but we rounded up to $1,000 in the proposal. That's something that we're certainly open to negotiating about. I think the most important piece of this bill for us is the concept of providing exempt protection for accounts that have exempt funds in them upfront at the bank level so that people are not put in a dire situation and forced to struggle to get their money back. So thank you very much.
Thank you. And we'll hear Jim's testimony and then some questions.
Thank you. Chair Bonamici, members of the committee, I'm Jim Kaur. I'm from Lane County Legal Aid and the University of Oregon School of Law. I'm testifying today in support of Senate Bill 731, which would protect exempt benefits from garnishment. I had some concern when I saw the bill that it's 46 pages long and that you might think it would be a major change in the Oregon garnishment procedure, but it would not. Most of the bill consists of the statutory garnishment forms that are given to the banks, to the creditor, and to the debtor, and those would be revised in minor ways to implement the provisions of the bill. I don't want to repeat what Ms. Hebb has already testified about. I've submitted written testimony, and I'll just jump to a few extra points. I've attached to my written testimony a chart which shows how the provisions of Senate Bill 731 would fit into the Oregon garnishment procedure. And the bill would make one simple change in the present garnishment procedure. Presently, when the bank receives a writ of garnishment, it examines its records to see if it has an account for the debtor, and if so, then it charges a garnishment fee, which, using the bank's right of offset, it deducts from the account and then pays the balance of the account to the creditor. The debtor then must file a challenge to garnishment to recover the money. Under Senate Bill 731, we would put a step, and it's at one additional step, and that's on the second line of boxes on the chart. When the bank receives a writ of garnishment, the bank would look to see if there's been direct deposit of exempt benefits in the last 45 days. And if so, then the bank would act according to the balance in the account. If there's been direct deposit of these exempt benefits and the balance is less than or equal to $2,500, then no funds would be garnished, and the creditor would be notified on the response to garnishment form that there are no funds in the account that are subject to garnishment. If the balance in the account is over $2,500, then the bank would pay the amount above $2,500 to the creditor using the same existing garnishment procedure that we have now. The debtor then could file a challenge to garnishment. So, for example, some Social Security recipients might have received a lump sum of benefits so that they actually have more than $2,500 in exempt funds in their account. Under Senate Bill 731, $2,500 would be protected at the bank. The remainder would be paid out under the writ of garnishment, but the debtor could file a challenge to assert the claim of exemption to the additional monies. If there has been no direct deposit of exempt funds in the last 45 days, then the bank would simply pay the funds in the account to the creditor exactly the same as it's done now. So it would be a very simple change. We think it would be very easy for the banks because credit unions because we see on account statements that deposits are already coded and specifically identified if they're Social Security, if they're SSI, if they're unemployment, for example. So the banks and financial institutions already have this information. So we think it would be a simple determination. They would simply look to see if those benefits have been deposited in the previous 45 days and then look at the balance of the account. And that's all that would be required by the banks. The instructions that are sent to the garnishee, to the financial institution, would specify the various benefits that are protected. It's Social Security, SSI, public assistance, retirement benefits, and then unemployment, veterans, and workers' comp. One of the questions, as Sybil mentioned, this is based on a New York bill that was passed last year and went into effect January 1 of this year. And one of the questions that we asked when we looked at the New York bill was, why did they pick $2,500 and why did they pick a fixed amount as opposed to saying we'll just protect the actual direct, the actual exempt funds? And what we learned was that the financial institutions in New York wanted a fixed amount, and that that's been the position of the banking institutions around the country. We understand that at least some people in Oregon have a different approach, but the financial institutions, for ease of administration and ease of implementation, wanted to have a bright line fixed amount so that they didn't have to go into the account in detail and apply accounting methods to determine what amount in the account was exempt. And I'll just quote from a statement that the Legislative Council for the Consumer Bankers Association sent to the Federal Reserve Board, where he said, at many, if not most, of CBA's member financial institutions, a labor-intensive manual identification process would be required if the bank were required to research every account reached by a garnishment to determine whether funds might be exempt, a time-consuming process that carries with it substantial risks of error. And that would be one of our concerns about having the banks try to make that determination, is that there would be a substantial risk of error and mistakes would be made. Now, as Sybil mentioned, there are five states that have enacted this type of protection because this is a problem nationwide. Three states, New York, California, and Connecticut, all have done it by legislation. Pennsylvania and Alabama have done it by court rule. $2,500 would protect most benefits, but not necessarily all. The maximum Social Security benefit now is $2,323 per month, but that goes up usually each year. I guess it might not this next year, but it has been going up around $100. It's gone up $200 over the last 2 years. We had thought about pegging the amount to be protected perhaps to that amount, to say that the amount protected would be the maximum Social Security amount as determined by Social Security Administration. The problem, and that could be done, the problem is, of course, that that amount would change each year, and it's not a nice round figure like $2,500. Some states, well, New York and California both have cost of living provisions in their statutes. Again, that creates some confusion. I know when I tried to find out what the current exempt amount in California was, it was very, very difficult. I was sent to a website which no longer exists, and really had a very difficult time. And so I suppose if the amount's changing every month or every year, it's going to require some type of notice to financial institutions to make sure that they're aware of the changes. So we settled on $2,500, but obviously there could be, it could be done in other ways. There has been concern about overprotection. This is something I was concerned about wouldn't this protect some, or couldn't this protect some non-exempt funds in the account? And the answer is that is possible. I'm not sure that that's a significant risk. I think that for people on SSI and public assistance, those are need-based programs. Those folks rarely have any significant assets other than their benefits. In fact, if they do have any significant assets, they're not going to be eligible for public assistance or SSI. As Sybil mentioned, they may receive gifts from family members, or sometimes a neighbor will loan them some money to help them pay their rent or their light bill, but those folks very rarely have any substantial assets. Now, in contrast to that, I think that people receiving Social Security and retirement benefits could have very substantial assets. They could have investments, sizable investments, and they could have assets and income from those investments. However, I would think that those people are less likely to have unpaid judgments. So I'm not sure that there's going to be significant overprotection in those cases. There are other people receiving Social Security benefits. According to Social Security Administration, one-third of their recipients have no other income other than Social Security. So for those people, they're much in the same boat as people on SSI or public assistance. There's one other, I think it might be worth mentioning, unemployment benefits. Someone might be receiving unemployment and have some other income or monies in the bank. But that protection, and so there might be some overprotection there, but it would only be temporary until the person was back to work. And at that point, the creditor would be able to collect either by garnishing their wages or could garnish the bank account at that point, since it would no longer be protected once the person was not receiving unemployment. So it would only be protected during the time period of time that the person receives unemployment benefits and for 45 days thereafter. I've attached to my testimony a summary of the provisions of the bill section by section. Sybil's already mentioned the major provisions. I'll just add a couple of points to what she said. With regard to the provision that note that the financial institution would not charge a garnishment fee if the funds are protected from garnishment, we see garnishment fees from $25 to $75 now. Those fees are taken out before the money is paid to the creditor, and so it actually the creditor gets less money when those fees are imposed. But we don't want to have fees imposed. We'd like the statute to be changed so that no fees are imposed if the funds are not garnishable. Interestingly enough, under the current statutes, the creditor's fee, the financial institution is limited to charging $10 to the creditor for a garnishment, but there is no limitation on the amount that they can charge to the debtor. With regard to the provisions to clarify that commingling does not affect the exempt status of the benefits and that the courts would use the FIFO accounting method to determine which benefits are exempt, I just point out that those both of those rules under our proposal would be applied by the court. If there's a challenge hearing, they would not be applied by the banks. I have seen the bank's alternative proposal, and I would have concerns on several accounts. In general, it's a good idea, which is to protect just the amount of the exempt funds. The problem is in the implementation. It's going to require the banks to do detailed examination of the accounts. It's going to increase the possibility of error, and it's going to be time-consuming. And during that time, my understanding is that the debtor's funds would be frozen, and so that could be would cause hardship to the debtors that have exempt funds. I'm concerned that that method would result in an increase in garnishment fees, which already can be quite substantial. And currently, the banks have no liability to debtors if they make a mistake. And that's probably appropriate under the current procedure, since under the current procedure, the banks do nothing more than to pay the money in the account to the creditors, and then the courts decide how it should end up. But if the bank is making the determination of what's exempt and not exempt, then I think that the banks should have liabilities to the debtors if they make mistakes. Currently, the banks do have liabilities to creditors, but no liability to debtors. Many of our most vulnerable people depend on these exempt benefits to survive. $674 a month is not much to live on, but that's all you have if you're on SSI. These folks depend on these benefits to arrive each month, and they plan accordingly. And our current garnishment procedure allows the disruption or the interruption of these benefits and penalizes people who have to go through the challenge process to recover their funds. I've attached, I received this morning, a statement from Gene Beachdell, who's the director of the Senior Law Service, and I attached that to my statement. Senior Law Service is a program in Lane County that was started by Ron Wyden when he was a law student at the University of Oregon. And volunteer attorneys provide legal services to seniors at the senior centers on Saturday mornings. And Ms. Beachdale writes about the increase in these kinds of cases, and one particular case that she remembers where a very frail man was repeatedly garnished with Social Security benefits in his bank account and tried to close the account so he wouldn't keep getting garnished, and couldn't close the account because he owed $240 in bank fees. So this is what's happening under the current procedure, and it's not the creditor's fault. It's the problem. The problem is with the Oregon garnishment procedure, and it can be changed. It doesn't require a major revision. It only requires a simple change, and Senate Bill 731 would do that. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and we'll open it up to questions. I just want to make a comment that while the legislative council draft was 42 pages, when they reprinted it, it's a mere 25 pages. I think it has something to do with a font or something. Senator Girard.
I got a couple questions. The first one is kind of a bonehead question, and I just want to make sure I'm reading this right. When we increase the wild card exemption in this bill from 400 to 1,000, that can't be used to compound with the 2,500. So that's restricted. There's no other exemptions other than the wild card exemption for that to apply. Is that not correct? Because on page 24, that's the way I read it.
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, you got a wild card. You have two exemptions here.
Right.
You have the $2,500 exemption, and then you got the wild card exemption. I want to make sure that that's not additive. And if I read page 24, that's the way I read it.
Okay. I think the concern is that if non-exempt funds were protected at the bank within the $2,500,
yeah,
then if the debtor claimed another $1,000,
well, that would make it 35.
It could make 3,500. It wouldn't be quite that much because there would have to be some public benefits or exempt benefits in the bank account for the 2,500 to be protected. In other words, the 2,500 doesn't apply unless there are exempt benefits in the bank account.
Right.
So, we had a conversation with legislative council about that, and at one point I had advanced a provision that would have addressed that, which would have said that any non-exempt funds that were protected at the bank would count against the wild card exemption. And that was taken out, and maybe that needs to be back in.
Madam Chair, if I just read this, interest in personal property to a value of, under this bill, $1,000, but this cannot be used to increase the amount of any other exemptions.
Right.
So, there would be an out on that because you're not increasing the amount of the exempt. So if they used the full $2,500, then this would bump it up to $3,500.
Unless there was the type of provision that I mentioned. That
yeah,
would,
well, I would think
and,
that.
And like I said, I had advanced that, and then legislative council took it out. And,
okay.
I didn't mention that the legislative council said, well, what do people use the wild card exemption for? You can't use it to increase the value of other exemptions. And I've seen essentially it's just used to protect non-exempt cash. Mm-hmm. So I've seen it used to protect tax refunds, mm-hmm, to protect gifts from family members, money, proceeds from the sale of an automobile or other property, and things of that nature. One woman cashed out her IRA because she couldn't pay her bills, and then her account was garnished, and the only amount she was allowed to get back was the wild card amount.
Okay. Which was $400.
Right.
Another question. You know, we just got done hearing a bill between tenants and renters, and they were able to come up with an agreement. And
right.
The bankers and the debt collectors seem to be the stumbling block is that they don't want commingled funds, and they want to go with not a set amount, but whatever the rental fund is. Why is I'm just trying to have an understanding here why you don't want to do that.
Chair Bonamici, Senator Girard, it's a good question. I think conceptually, as Jim mentioned, it's not a bad idea. Our concern, again, is with the implementation. And there are a number of concerns which I've expressed to Jim and to Mr. Martinez. From our perspective, as Jim mentioned, we'd basically be taking, if the banks were doing this analysis, we'd basically be taking what is right now done by a judge who's got training and standards and where there are ways to make sure each side has
it say, and transferring that to the person at the bank who's assigned with this responsibility. So there would need to be some training and some standards in place by which that analysis took place. Assuming that that could get done and that that was workable, we would want to make sure that it was workable for all banks. So big banks, small banks. I understand that there are some, there's not certainty about whether that proposal actually does work for banks, but let's assume that it does. If it would work for all sizes of banks, then I think there's some additional issues that would need to be taken into account. Number one is, how long will it take for that assessment to take place? And are the person's protected funds going to be put on hold and frozen and, you know, denied to them during that time frame? And if there was a very quick turnaround, or there was some basic minimum level of protection that existed while that analysis was taking place, then that would resolve some of the concerns. And I've let people know that. I think the other issue is, as Jim mentioned, liability. And again, this goes to how the banks feel about that detailed proposal versus our sort of simple proposal. But if there are analyses that have that impact on people's lives and there's a judgment and a training sort of process involved there, then there needs to be some assurance that there are reasonable standards in place and some liability requirement for good faith compliance with those standards. I think the other aspect is that, I think that would be very expensive to implement because it would take time and it would require training and procedures. And so the concern that we would have at that point is what would be the fees that would be involved and would that be something that would work to the detriment of the protected funds that are in the account. So those are the practical concerns. The principal concerns that we have that I've also expressed are that the bottom line is we're trying to make sure that people who are vulnerable are not sort of without warning taken to zero in their accounts in a way that causes them to not be able to pay their rent or not be able to buy their food or their medicines. And the proposal that the banks have put forward would not address that concern because people could still be taken to zero through that process.
Can I interrupt you just for a second? I don't understand how they can be taken to zero if they have exempted funds. The bank recognizes the exempted fund as the amount that the prior check was, and that can't be taken to zero.
Chair Bonamici, Senator Rudd, I think that the way, according to what I understand the bank's proposal to be, is that they would be asking their staff to do a first-in, first-out analysis of the account. So let's say $500 in Social Security came in on the first of the month, and then on the second of the month, $100 from your mother came in. So now I've got $600 in the account. There's $100 of it that's not technically otherwise exempt, but the next, I pay my light bill for $38, or probably more like $300, but I pay my light bill, that gets taken out of the initial exempt fund deposit. Mm-hmm. And so whatever's left over in the, so the amount of exempt dollars in the account goes down, and any leftover money, if there is any, may be non-exempt and could then get garnished without notice in the same way that it is currently.
And one thing I'd like to say is next on the list of panels is the Ken Chairman Tim Martinez from the Bankers Association. So I think it would be helpful if we asked them questions, too.
Well, they will. They'll get asked. I just think that this should be able to be compromised.
Chair Bonamici, if I may, I just also wanted to make sure, and I forgot to mention this earlier, that we have been working with the Department of Justice, representatives of the Child Support Division, and other aspects of the Department of Justice to make sure that the proposal works for them. They have expressed some concerns about the level of minimum protection, and we've let them know that we're open to negotiating that number, and we're also looking at how to make to deal with child support judgments, which have different rules related to their garnishment procedures. So just wanted to put that on the record.
Any other questions for this panel? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Senators. Thank you.
So next we're going to hear from Ken Sherman and Tim Martinez from the Oregon Bankers Association. And then after that, just for planning purposes, Brigadier General Mike Caldwell and Paul Evans. And then after that will be Pam Levitt and Hal Scroggins for the credit union. Does that work? Before they get started, General Caldwell and Mr. Evans, are you able to stay? Because I think the credit union people have to go. So, okay, they're fine. So we'll do this panel and then Pam Levitt and Hal Scoggins for the credit unions. Welcome.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, member of the committee, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. I'm joined by Ken Sherman, longtime counsel for the Oregon Bankers Association. As you'll remember, Ken testified last week when this was still a concept, or I guess it was in print at that point, but not yet in the possession of the committee. We had actually started talking prior to your informational meeting about was there a creative way to accomplish what the proponents wanted to get done, and they've certainly, last panel certainly spent a lot of time describing what banks might or might not be able to do. We hope to be able to clear up what banks might or might not be able to do in this area. As Ken mentioned last time, we did he did meet with the OBA Bank Operations Committee at great length the day after your hearing, and they went through this very carefully to make sure that if we were to propose it, it was something that we could deliver. We've also now talked to some of our larger members. Ken, I think, might relay a little bit of that conversation as well, and they believe what we propose is also doable. We're certainly not interested in presenting something and moving forward on something that we can't deliver upon, but as Ken will make it very clear, we think we can. And the last thing I would say before I turn it over to Mr. Sherman is that our detailed proposal, as it was described, compared to the simple proposal that was mentioned earlier, takes about the same number of words, so we don't have a lot more detail in ours. With that, I would let Mr. Sherman deliver the nuts and bolts of what we propose.
Thank you,
Madam Chairman, member of the committee. I'm Ken Sherman. I'm counsel for the Oregon Bankers Association. I've placed before you two things. First of all, some detailed testimony, which I'm not going to read to you, and also our proposed revisions to the bill. There are no changes in these revisions from what you have seen earlier, so I just wanted you to have a fresh copy of them today. I want to begin by pointing out that I think the Oregon Bankers Association, in dealing with this issue, as it has been noted, has been dealt with in several states across the country, has really been unique among state associations in that we have not opposed this bill. We have not failed to recognize that there's a problem with these exempt funds, and we have tried to play a constructive role. In every other state, as far as I know, the banking association has started out in opposition, strong opposition to this bill. Bankers are concerned about this for two reasons, because they wear two hats. They are the people who hold the bank accounts that we're focusing on here, but they're also people to whom occasionally are owed debts that have to be collected. So they're both a creditor and a repository for the funds that we're concerned about. But we have recognized for some time that there is a problem with this 18-348 that says that these various exempt funds, when placed in a bank account, are to remain exempt as long as they're identifiable up to a certain limit, and then Social Security deposit, of course, there is no dollar limit on that. The problem, as I think has been well identified, is that it's all well and good to say that those funds are exempt, but the practical matter is that the bank has to turn those over in the face of a garnishment, and then our customer has to go through the process of claiming an exemption. That can be expensive, it can be beyond the level of sophistication of the customer, and it most importantly can involve significant delays in getting the funds back into the customer's hands. And that can cause a cascade of other problems that I think have been pretty clearly identified. Looking at Senate Bill 731, we see that as affecting a partial fix to the problem, and I'll explain my comment about partial in a minute. But the great problem that we, wearing that second hat as collector, as creditors have, is that this bill really creates a new exemption. It says that if you've got $200 remaining that are exempt funds in your account, and you've got another $2,300 in that account that are not exempt funds, we've just created a new $2,300 exemption. And frankly, I think that's intellectually dishonest. If we want to create a new exemption in Oregon law, there's another chapter where or another section where we collect all those exemptions, and we should go in there and we should put an exemption in for $2,300 to fit that circumstance. But this is a backdoor way of accomplishing that, and accomplishing it only selectively. It won't help everybody. It'll only help those people who happen to be in that time frame of having spent out most of their exempt funds. So we don't think that's a very good fix. Now, I said a moment ago that we see Section 2 of the printed bill as a partial solution, not a complete solution, with regard to protecting exempt funds. And I think that's a tragic problem with the printed bill. The example I would use is very simple. You've got a case where our customer has accumulated $4,000 in their account, $4,000 of Social Security funds. Garnishment comes along under the printed version of the bill. The first $2,500 of that is going to be set aside and protected. But the other $1,500 of that $4,000 is going to go out the door, and the customer that we're trying to protect is going to still have to go through that same exempt process, making the claim, waiting for the funds to get back into the account. Hopefully they'll be successful in doing that. But we've put them through the same trouble for that $1,500 that the current law puts them through for the $4,000. Our version, where we identify exempt funds, would protect all of the exempt funds that have come into the account over the last 45 days, every one of them. If it's $10,000 in retirement benefits and Social Security and whatever else it may be, it's all going to be protected. None of it's going to be subject to garnishment. And I think that's a terrific improvement over the printed version of the bill. One of the things that I think we have to recognize is because that is an improvement, it would significantly reduce the number of hearings that we would have to have. Now, both of these bills will reduce the number of exempt claim hearings because both of them will protect funds, and in some cases, even Senate Bill 731 will mean that you don't have to go and file an exempt claim and go through the hearing process. But in our bill, we're going to protect all the exempt funds, so we should pretty much reduce to zero the number of exemption hearings. That's going to have a positive revenue impact on the state of Oregon. And I don't think anybody's talked about revenue impact with regard to this bill, but I think it's there. The rest of the bill, I think, pretty much falls into place. I do want to respond to a couple of things that were said earlier. First of all, with regard to this horribly complex first-in, first-out concept that people seem to be so concerned that bankers aren't going to be able to handle that. We got that idea out of this bill. It's in Section 4 on page 3, and it says when we get to the rest of the funds, after you've taken care of the $2,500, when you get to the rest of the funds, you apply this FIFO analysis to determine what's exempt and what's not exempt. So we're just using the drafter's own idea for that, and I am here to say with some confidence that our bankers are quite capable, thank you, of carrying out that calculation. They're going to do it on a computer. Somebody said, well, is this going to take days or weeks? It's going to take an instant. I mean, it's really a very simple thing to program the computers to do that. I talked this morning. Tim mentioned that we ran this through the Bank Operations Committee last week, and they were very supportive of this and felt that it was a much more appropriate and fair approach. I talked this morning to a lady named Janet McGilliard, who for 30 years has run the Garnishment Department at U.S. National Bank. They are the largest holder of accounts in Oregon. And I sent all of this off to her about 3 days ago, and I called her this morning, and I said, well, we got a hearing this afternoon. Tell me what you think. And she said, this is a good idea. We can make this work. It will not be a problem for us. Now, I have to tell you in full disclosure that I have not heard back yet from the Wells Fargo people or Bank of America, the two other people that I'm checking with on this. But I had 16 people on our bank operations committee from all sides of Oregon banks, the smallest to Umpqua, which is the largest state-chartered bank, and they were unanimous in their support for our approach. So we're confident that we can make this work, and we're confident that it's a better approach. At this point, I think I should stop and ask if you have any questions.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Senator Girard.
I promised. Okay. I want to see this negotiated out. Okay. Sybil had three things that she was concerned about. One is the time frame as to how long this could take. So, yeah, I mean, you said that you hit a button and it'd be an instant, so it sounds to me like we can do this under your proposal in a fairly rapid, so that, you know, 1, 2, 3 day. What could we?
Madam Chairman, Senator Girard, the law now, the garnishment law, says that a garnishee has 5 days to respond to a garnishment.
5 days, okay.
And so we've got ample time built into the law right now to do this calculation. It is not going to be that difficult.
She was concerned about the liability if you make mistakes.
We have a contract with every deposit customer, and if we ying when we should yang under that contract, we're going to have liability.
Okay.
That's not going to change.
In that you might raise your fees.
Yes, and that's built into this bill. We are now authorized by law to take a $10 garnishment search fee. There will be additional expense involved in this. That fee has not been raised for quite a number of years. I didn't go back and check mm-hmm. how many. But just as $400 becomes $1,000, we believe that in this case $10 should become $15. So that is provided for in the amendments that
okay.
I submitted to you.
And Madam Chair, Senator Grove, that's on page 4 in section 6. You'll see that change from $10 to $15.
Okay.
Other questions?
I'm good.
I wanted to ask about there are, I think, 5 other states that do this, 2 by court order. Has any other state taken this approach, or did the other states take the minimum amount?
I have not, Madam Chairman, had an opportunity to do that kind of research into this. I haven't talked to the American Bankers Association, and I haven't gone to the other states. In fact, I would like to get a list of those other states so that I could do a little bit of that looking. But I apparently, and I take this from the earlier testimony, at least 1 or 2 states have looked at this, and I think one of the banking officials said they thought that this would make the process more cumbersome. You know, that makes sense to me. I mean, I'm just a layperson. I don't do the mechanics of this stuff, but I go to the people that do it all the time, and the young lady at U.S. that I referred to, I've been working on garnishment law in this state since the early 70s, and working with her, her career and mine have just about paralleled, and she's always been at U.S., I've always been with the Oregon Bankers, and she knows more about garnishment by far than I ever will, and that's all she does. It sounds like an incredibly boring job, but I keep making it more interesting for her. She says this is not going to be difficult to implement.
And, Madam Chair, we would hope that just because other states haven't done it doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad idea.
That's right.
I'm not saying that it is. I just am curious if other states are doing it. Maybe we could get some background on how it's working. And I also wanted to clarify, there seems to be some people think it's 5 days, some people think it's 7 days.
They've changed it a couple of times. It may be 7. I think it's 7 calendar days down.
7 calendar
days. Before it
okay.
was 5 business days, which is kind of the same thing, but it could be as many as 9 calendar days, I guess.
Just to
but
clarify.
But at any rate, I think right now the law says 7 calendar days, and I appreciate your correcting me on that.
Thank you. Wasn't necessarily me correcting you, just trying to clarify the record because I wasn't convinced of the answer. Thank you very much. Any other questions, Senator Girard?
Madam Chair, one thing I'd like to point out is if you fix the rate at $2,500, that's only good for a few years, unless you add a COLA charge or you go correct the statute. If you do it this way, you don't have to update the statute every few years or put a COLA clause in there, which is going to be extremely confusing. So, you know, just from a policy perspective, this might be unique, but I think that it would be a better approach.
Thank you. Did you have any questions in church? Thank you very much for your testimony, and I certainly
you.
Appreciate all the work you've done on this.
Thank
Next,
you.
We're going to hear from Pam Levitt and Hal Scoggins. I hope I said your name right.
Thank you. Chair Bonamici, members of the committee, I'm Pam Levitt with the Credit Union Association of Oregon. On March 10th, we submitted some written testimony in your informational hearing that really addresses some of the issues that we had concerns with under Senate Bill 731. We have not had the opportunity to send out the new OBA proposal to our membership for review. We just received it yesterday afternoon, and we'd like to have that opportunity. House Goggins is the attorney for the credit unions, and we've quickly been assessing some of the thoughts, and he has some comments. But I do commend the OBA for coming up with a proposal, and I do agree with Senator Girard that we should be all working together to try to come up with a compromise. There's a lot of thoughts and opinions. We have some differing opinions than other organizations, and I think we probably, you just need to lock us all in a room for the weekend.
I'm tempted.
I'll turn it over to Hal.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Hal Scoggins. I'm an attorney with Farley Wada Witt, and we are the counsel for the Credit Union Association of Oregon and a number of credit unions throughout Oregon. And as Pam said, we haven't fully vetted this issue with our constituent credit unions yet, so I don't know that we can speak definitively for them at this point. What I can say is that credit unions are concerned about the exemption process and about the fairness issues that have been raised here today. Credit unions do recognize that that is a problem and an issue that can be dealt with in a positive way. Our biggest concern, banks, credit unions are in both situations. They are creditors who sometimes garnish accounts, but they are also institutions that hold the accounts and have to deal with the garnishments as they come in. And in that capacity, the credit union's concern is no different than it is at any other time with respect to a deposit account where you have different people involved or interested in that deposit account. Tell us what the rule is and we'll follow it. We just don't want to have to pay the same money out twice. That's the ultimate concern. And there are some things involved in this that I think credit unions are concerned about, both with the bill and with the subsequent proposal from the OBA. One is that it's in most cases easy to identify some of these exempt funds. Social Security deposits are clearly identified that way. Other types of deposits clearly identified, unemployment compensation. Some of the payments that are identified in this bill are not necessarily always easy to identify as such. And I think we'd like to see a standard that provides a little more protections for the financial institutions in how they make those identifications. Payments from a retirement plan, payments from workers' comp. You know, lots of insurance or financial services companies will send ACH credits to financial institutions, and those payments may or may not be identified specifically as retirement payments. So, frankly, we think that the bill should say that if the payment itself is identified when it's transmitted as one of these types of payments, that's when the responsibility is triggered, as opposed to if we can reasonably identify it. Because I guarantee you, people will disagree on whether financial institutions can reasonably identify some of these payments as such. That's one concern that our credit unions have identified. Another is the fairness concern. Of course, everybody would like a rule that's easy to follow. On the other hand, the specific amount rule has some drawbacks to it. There's no real good, easy solution to this issue, but I can certainly envision a situation where somebody has $2,500 in their account that includes $1,500 worth of payments from family members or whatever non-exempt sources there may be. There was a deposit in the last 30 days of $400 in exempt funds, but now we've converted that whole $2,500 to exempt funds. And credit unions are definitely concerned about the fairness aspect of that. On the other hand, credit unions also have concerns about the FIFO calculation. And yes, the accounting is easy to do, and I am confident that credit union people can do those calculations as easy as judges will be able to do them. perhaps more so. But there are time restraints that are at play that I think need to be fully considered. If a garnishment comes in at 3:45, it has to be processed on the basis of that day's funds. And if checks come in to be paid, they have to be paid by the midnight deadline the following day. And so that effectively means that that calculation has to be done by the end of the following day. Ordinary circumstances, that's probably not an issue. There may be circumstances where that may be an issue. And then what happens if there's a disagreement about that, or if funds were held pending that calculation and checks were bounced based on that, and then the calculation later shows that checks could have been paid. I mean, there's a number of issues that we would like to see a little more fully vetted and dealt with in the legislation, I think. Ultimately, again, the credit unions are concerned with fairness and want a rule that is simple and easy to follow. We think we can get there, but we don't think that that the draft that is in front of the committee right now gets us there yet.
Thank you for your testimony. And I did want to remark that during conversations with some of the players here today, we did have a discussion about a good faith exemption from liability because we understand that there's a lot of work to be done, and with the time frame and that kind of thing, we'd want to have that sort of exemption.
Senator Gerard, did you have a
Yeah, I do, and that is on the first in, first out calculations. You seem to have a little bit of problem with that. Would it be more conducive if you just said that the exemption would be 30 days worth of exempted funds? So, I mean, where it would be, or 45 days or whatever it is, that how much exempted funds went in there in the past 45 days, that would be the value of the exemption, or 30 days. That seems to be a lot easier calculation to me.
Chair Bonamici, Senator Gerard, that might be an easier calculation. I think that has some benefits, but it also has drawbacks. I mean, again, the fairness issue comes into play, and as I said before, I don't think that there's any perfect solution to this problem. And if you say that there was a $1,000 deposit in the last 30 days, and now and then all of that $1,000 was withdrawn, and then a subsequent non-exempt deposit of $1,500 came in, are we now saying that that $1,500 is exempt because the amount of the original deposit we say 1,000 of that is exempt because the original 1,000 was exempt, but in reality, none of that $1,500 should be exempt. I mean, there is a fairness issue there, and again, I don't think there's any perfect solution.
Well, Madam Chair, given the fact that we have a wild card exemption to boot, so I understand your plight, but it seems to me like one of those first in, first out, or a set amount predicated on the amount that was deposited would be far better, and you wouldn't need any inflationary clauses, than a set amount like $2,500.
Madam Chair, Senator Gerard, that does bring up a very good issue, which is that I think it needs to be clear that the wildcard exemption is kept out of this, and that is an exemption that's claimed by the debtor separately and outside of this process. And the only exemption that the financial institutions are looking at is whatever method we ultimately determine is to be applied to the funds in the account, without respect to the idea that other exemptions may be claimed through the regular exemption process on funds that are in that account. But that is a matter that would be taken up through the regular exemption process by the debtor in front of a judge, and it would not be the responsibility of the financial institutions to attempt to make those claims on behalf of the debtor.
But just so I understand, Senator Gerard, you're suggesting the possibility of considering for each individual, you take that amount of exempt funds that they get per month, and that's the amount that's
Mm-hmm.
So
that's just an idea.
I just want to make sure I understand. Other questions, Senator George? I have a question. Do you have a sense of how often this is happening with your members?
Meaning how often
garnishment of exempt funds. Is it something you deal with on a daily basis? Is it... occasional.
For me, I only deal with it when there's trouble and I get the phone call that, okay, somebody's disputing what we've done. And
right.
And that is the viewpoint that I have. I do believe that our financial institutions see this on a daily basis. There are debtors that have exempt funds that are being garnished. But every one of those situations is different, and that's the problem here is, yeah, there are people that have $2,300 Social Security payments that come in that are exempt, and maybe they don't have any other deposits to their account, but there are people that have a $400 retirement payment come into their account. They're already working a second career, receiving their payment from their 20 years on their first job of $400, and this bill would convert, again, the first $2,500 in that account to be entirely exempt based on the $400 deposit when they're already working a second job. And we do recognize there are debtors that are in bad shape, don't have income from any other source, and they need to be protected. But there are also people out there that maybe can pay, but they've just decided not to pay. My office deals with those people all the time.
We recognize that. At some point, I'd like to get some sort of general sense, doesn't need to be specific, about sort of the market share of accounts in credit unions versus accounts in banks.
Madam Chair, similar answer to how we get the calls to, at the Trade Association when there are issues. And so, you know, we certainly can put a word out. It might be not be a statewide example, but we can get some information from our membership to give you a snapshot.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
General Caldwell and Mr. Evans, please. Welcome back.
Thank you. Madam Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Military Department. You testified last week in your informational hearing on this bill. I think we remain steadfast in that we think this would be a good situation for you to work out obvious issues that you need to get. I think our concern is that we know that we have a lot of veterans and we have other exempt or other folks who receive exempt funds. That's all they have to deal with, and sometimes we have heard of those situations where they're down to their last two nickels, and then all of a sudden they get a garnishment. We don't advocate people not taking care of their responsibilities, and we advocate that we will try to help them through the numerous programs that are available to assist veterans, particularly in our lane, and we're willing to do that. We've done that to a great deal over the last several years as we've seen more of these issues arise where people get overextended. And we certainly had good outreach from our community of Oregon, and totally community of Oregon, to assist in donating funds and other assets to try to help these soldiers out and veterans out as they run into these difficulties. So I think as a matter of course, I think you're on the right track. We certainly endorse the bill. We endorse what you're doing, trying to find that sweet spot to make it work the best for everybody, and certainly would encourage you to drive forward and pass the bill.
Thank you for your testimony. Carl?
Madam Chair, members of the committee. That's right.
We're up to members now.
A long day. I want to echo what General Caldwell said and put just a couple of points on it and let you get on to your next folks coming up. But earlier today, both of us were actually at a couple of different events that I think are important for at least the veterans' perspective on this issue. We met today with, it was the every 6 month Veterans Summit, where folks from across the state come together and try to talk about the challenges the veterans community are currently going through. There's an emphasis on the National Guard Reserve and reintegration, but it's really for veterans of all ages and all wars. And with the economy hitting the way it is, the concern for veterans are growing because veterans aren't often the folks that ask for help very quick. And often, if you can get them to ask for help once, that they don't always ask for help that second or third time. And it's especially salient today because it is the sixth anniversary of the activities in Iraq, of which I went twice. And in 6 years, a lot of people's lives can come undone. And I, too, believe that soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines should answer their responsibilities. But I also know from my own experience and the experience of some of my guys and gals that they find themselves in tough spots. And bottom line is, I'm not smart enough to even understand the difference between the two proposals currently before you. What I am smart enough to know is that there is a difference between interest and commitment. And my grandpa used to remind me that the difference between interest and commitment, you can look at a ham omelet, that the chicken's interested, but the pig's committed. Today, I'm asking you guys to be committed. Find a solution to this problem. Find one that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Find one that makes sure that we don't leave even one veteran in a situation where, because of circumstances beyond their control and the fixed income that a government in 2, 3, 4, 5 years down the road, that it will increasingly forget about veterans because the war is no longer first or second or third page. I'm asking you to find a solution that will stand the test of time, that will help the veterans and their families get back up on their feet. You really have that power before you. So thank you for this
opportunity. Thank you so much for your testimony. I have a question. I was trying to find out how many or what the percentage is of deposits online, and I found electronic deposits. I found the Social Security website says 80% of Social Security, Social Security benefits and SSI beneficiaries receive benefits by direct deposit as of December 2007. And I found something where the Veterans Administration encourages using direct deposit. Do you have a sense of the percentage of deposits that are online?
Madam Chair, members of the community and the committee, there's a couple of things that are happening. Number one, the folks that are serving, that's the world they know, direct deposit.
Right.
Number two, because of continued efficiencies at the federal level, you flat just don't. It's harder to get your check in a hard copy than it is through direct deposit. So they, I don't want to say force, that's a little bit too strong, but they certainly make it far easier to do direct deposit than any other form. So I would suspect it's probably at least the 80%, if not higher, and the reason for that is that military folks generally, when they're told to do something, will do it that way. So I would suspect probably in the 80 to 85% category, would be my guess.
Madam Chairman, in our organization, you don't get paid without having direct deposit. It's just, I would say we're probably 99% direct deposit, and the only 1% that isn't paid is usually an anomaly that something occurred that was wrong in the system, and they had to go back and hand work that particular 1%, if even that. It's just extremely difficult to get a check. I haven't seen one in 15, 20 years. In fact, I had, when we first converted to that, it's an interesting story, probably more than you want to hear, but I had several of my older World War II guys. I was a young lieutenant, and they were getting to the age where they were about ready to retire, and we only got paid every 3 months in those days in the Guard. And they came into my office because I was down to like five people that hadn't signed up for SurePay. And I said, "Why aren't you guys signing up for SurePay?" And they said, "Well, we got a little problem." And I said, "What's the problem?" I said, "Our wives don't think we get paid for this stuff. So we don't have an account. If we put it in our regular accounts, they'll notice that we have pay in there." So I said, "How long have you been in this organization?" I said, "I've been there 35 years.
Oh,
and they said, I finally made him a deal and found him a banker who would set up a separate account and work with him because they didn't want to sign up.
Well, the secret's out now, General.
Right. So I would, and that's been a long time ago. I mean, it has been forever since we've been paid by checks. It just simply doesn't happen. And I would suspect that the Veterans Administration is very much the same way. If not getting there, they're going to get there pretty quick.
Thank you for your testimony and for your service.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next, I'm going to have Al Menashe from Clackamas County. It says, come on up, Al.
Wanted us to be committed.
And I know Al Menashe, but it's the other one, I guess.
My cousin.
Welcome.
I'm Albert Menashe. I own Central Finance Company. I'm coming at this from a little different perspective. And I believe this bill, the intention of it, from what I've heard, is to protect exempt funds from being garnished. And the hassle that people go through when their exempt funds are garnished and then they have to go to court and it takes them 30 to 60 days to get their money back. But the bill as you have written it is basically giving everybody a $3,500 exemption or $2,500 exemption plus a wild card. So what you're saying, if you pass this bill, is $3,500 of your bank account is exempt, whether or not they're exempt funds. The general public, workers, working families, if they're wrong, they go to small claims court and they get a judgment. Well, if you can't collect the judgment, there's no incentive for people to repay debt. Credit is a pretty sacred trust. There is an expectation that when one lends money to people, they should pay it back. And a poor guy, he's owed $300, and the guy that owes it to him works under the table, and he puts his money in his bank account. And if the guy can't garnish the bank account, he can't get his money. And if the general public knows that if its money is exempt, they're not going to pay. $2,500 is just too big an exemption for non-exempt funds. I believe that exempt funds should never be garnished. And you've got to find a way to protect the exempt funds, but don't use this bill to give people a $3,500 free exemption from repayment of their debt. Thank you.
Thank you. One thing I do want to clarify is that if you look at Section 2, the way it's written, if a writ of garnishment is delivered to a financial institution and any payment described in Subsection 2, which are the exempt funds, was deposited in one of those accounts by direct deposit. So it doesn't apply to everybody. It applies to people who have exempt funds deposited by direct deposit. So it is limited to people with accounts with a direct deposit of the exempt funds that are listed.
I understand that. So if a person has $200, if he gets a small Social Security check of $200, yet he puts $2,000 of his hard work, of his under-the-table money in his bank account, then none of that money is attachable. You understand?
Sure, I understand.
Okay, good.
Right. And the way we see it is that that's not likely to happen often.
It happens all the time.
Well, we
there are a
you.
Lot of people that get small payments, $200-$300 disability checks. They're still out working.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Manassi? Thank you for being here and say hi to your cousin. Next, we have a panel of Matt Wallace, Angela Martin, and Graham Trainer. Welcome. Did you decide who's going first?
All right. In the order we were called. For the record, Matt Wallace with Osberg. I want to thank you for the opportunity to come before you today in support of Senate Bill 731. I'll keep my comments brief. There's been great discussion about the issues here. I just want to reinforce that from our standpoint, and at least my standpoint as the consumer advocate for the organization, it's just extremely critical that these funds that are just designed for folks to cover just the bare necessities and basic necessities of living are treated the way they're meant to be treated under federal and state law, and that we have sort of a protection in place at the bank account level to make sure that folks continue to hold on to those funds. And then the only other piece I wanted to emphasize, because I think it has it's certainly been mentioned but not emphasized, is the key importance of also protecting consumers from garnishment fees, especially when those funds are exempt. And this feeds into consumer issues that we're very concerned about, for across the economy as... as the economy gets worse, we're seeing especially the big banks get more and more of their funds from, penalty fees and penalty charges as a share of their income. And we're seeing consumers across the economic spectrum get nickeled and dimed by all sorts of fees. And especially for the consumers that are the most vulnerable, we want to make sure, and this bill does that, that we're, protecting those consumers from extra fees, which was mentioned, can range anywhere between $25 and $75. So we think that that's a key piece as well. And wanted to call attention to that from the consumer protection angle. And that's it. So I'll leave my comments there.
Thank you, Matt. Angela?
Good afternoon, Chair Von Amici, members of the committee. Angela Martin with Our Oregon. I, too, will keep my comments brief. I'm heartened to hear how much support there is for solving this problem, recognizing that there is a problem. It at this point goes without saying that the economic crisis is hitting every family. I think it also goes without saying that we can expect it to get worse before it gets better. If we look at default rates, 57% increase in the number of credit card defaults in the last 3 years. Unemployment increasing. We know the pressures on families are hard. Something else that came to my mind, obviously there are a lot of folks searching for a solution to this problem. And a conversation that I often had with my mother came to mind. When I faced a problem, she would say, "You can solve the problem, or I'll solve it for you. And I promise you, you won't like my solution." It strikes me that both the creditors and the financial industry have recognized and stated today that they understand that this is a problem. I'm going to guess that they understood it was a problem before this proposed legislation came forward and could have implemented the solution they're advising prior to this bill. I offer that not to chastise an industry, but simply reflect on what my mother would always say. If you recognize a problem, the burden should be on you to go out and find the solution to it. Under our current system, the burden rests upon those who are least able to understand their protections and least able to go out and take care of the problem after it's happened. One more comment I'd like to offer is in regards to the wild card. I think it's appropriate and important that we update the value of this wild card from the 1981 level to the 2009 level. As I was considering how a family might apply this wild card, it was pointed out to me that while wages are exempt from garnishment to a certain degree, you can only attach 25% of my wages, your tax return, which is my wages coming back to me in another form, is not protected from garnishment. Certainly at this time when we have families who are expecting a tax return, have largely budgeted into their family income, it makes sense to update the wild card so that they could cover their wages coming back to them through their tax refund. With that, I'll close, and thank you so much for your consideration. I urge you to seek a simple solution and adopt 731. Thank you.
Thank you. Graham?
Chair Bonamici, members of the committee, my name is Graham Trainer, representing the Oregon AFL-CIO. The Oregon AFL-CIO represents over 225,000 Oregonians and is a leading voice on health care reform, living wages, working conditions, and retirement security. I will keep my comments brief, but did want to focus on just two areas that the Oregon AFL-CIO is specifically concerned about, and that is the garnishment of protected wages in the form of unemployment insurance and workers' compensation benefits. Some of our affiliates right now are seeing unemployment rates in the upwards of 50% in their respective industries. Unemployment rate in Oregon is 10.8%, as we all know, 3 percentage points higher than the national average. And again, just to belabor the point, these benefits, along with others, are exempt from collection under state and federal law, despite these current regulations. Creditors often garnish these protected funds from bank accounts, and Oregonians receiving unemployment and workers' compensation benefits are among the most vulnerable, as we all know. And, you know, these folks are barely making ends meet. The Oregon AFL-CIO feels that it's unfair to expect these affected individuals to, after the fact, rectify the situation through the means that have been laid out prior to my testimony. The Oregon AFL-CIO supports a workable solution, and you know, there have been lots of concerns specifically regarding the minimum level of protected funds, and in these economic times, again, the Oregon AFL-CIO feels that a workable solution to SB 731 is the right thing to do.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions?
And sure. I just wanted to say, Matt was talking about the fact that there were nickel and diming people to death with fees and all of these things, and I got to tell you, I'm doing my part. I'm voting no on every single one of them that comes across my desk. So just, you know, I'm looking for that strong rating from Osberg for doing that.
Thank you. Thank you. Matt, are you going to respond?
I'm just taking a cheap shot, as you know.
One of the things that I wanted to also add is that when I was at the beginning of the hearing talking about some of the documents that had been provided to us, I neglected to mention the letter from the AARP, March 19th, 2009, in support of Senate Bill 731. So I wanted to make sure that everyone has that and know that AARP, who's not here today, did submit that testimony, written testimony in support. I was looking at some of the comments that came in. There was a discussion at the federal level. The Comptroller of the Currency had a discussion about this issue. They actually posted something and took comments for over a comment period. And it's online. I was skimming them before the hearing. It might be worthy to look at some of those comments and see what people are saying at the national level about the solutions. I think everybody certainly recognizes the problem. It's trying to find the solution, which we will continue to work on. So I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 731, and I'm actually going to, if you can bear with me for just a minute, we had the bills in the other order on the agenda, and someone showed up who wanted to testify about Senate Bill 771. Is he still here?
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 771 for the testimony of Mr. Baker.
Madam Chair, my name is John Baker. I appreciate your, and members of the committee, appreciate your allowing me to come in. I came in and I didn't see the sign-up sheet. So just to give you my background, I'm a real estate licensee. I've been licensed and practicing for 32 years. And also our firm, which is just down the street here, has been involved in property management for 28 of those years. And I just learned of Senate Bill 771 1 week ago, and unfortunately I'm going to rain on some of the parade of some of the comments from this committee regarding having the landlords and the tenant interests locked hand in hand. I would say that if the general property managers and landlords knew what was in this bill, they would not be very happy and be caught off guard. So I'm going to speak just a few points, particularly about the 60-day no-cause tenancy provision of this bill. One of the things that I don't know who's on this coalition. I have been involved quite a bit. I've served as past president of the Oregon Association of Realtors. You would think that organization, the largest trade group regarding real estate, would be involved, but they're not on that coalition. And so there's no general stream of information out to us regarding what sort of things are happening in these 18, or you could count them. I didn't even know that they were talking about this. But let's get to the point. First off, the fact that after a tenant is there for a year, they would be owed a 60-day notice to terminate, and yet they would not have the same responsibility to give landlord or property manager that same 60-day notice seems to be inequitable at the very least. And that's what I thought the landlord-tenant law was supposed to be, kind of equitable on both sides. But the other thing that you have to keep in mind is when you change it from a 30-day notice to a 60-day notice, there's some unintended consequences that now begin to occur that when I talked to one member on the coalition wasn't even part of their discussion. And that's because a lot of them come from a multifamily residential. We specialize in single-family residential, and also I'm a real estate broker selling clients into those type and out of those investments. Let me give you a couple issues that come up. It causes problems with real estate sales because when we sell a property that might be occupied by a tenant that's there over a year to an owner-occupant, that owner-occupant financial documents is signing an agreement that they will be occupying that property within 30 days of closing. And here you now create this situation where a buyer may be in default of lender documents. Also, in a real estate transaction, you have to weigh when you're going to give a notice in order to facilitate repairs, et cetera, and a closing date. So that is one unintended consequence. Another is if a tenant's been there longer than a year, I think the rationale is somehow that's assumed that that's going to be a better tenant. And that's not necessarily true, because when we go through our process to qualify a tenant, we do criminal background, public records, credit. And so the tenant doesn't have problems initially. It's usually after a period of time. That's when loss of job, marital, or drugs, or some sort of thing interdicts into the household. And more than half of our tenants, in single family, our tenancies are longer. About half of our tenants are a year older. So we're now have a situation where I've served here in the city of Salem on a nuisance house task force, and the city of Salem initially wanted to have nuisances resolved in 15 days, and I told them, I said, I'm sorry, our only avenue is a 30-day no-cause notice, so they moved it to, I think, 45 days. So now, with this 60-day notice, now you have a situation where you are creating problems where landlords can no longer solve issues, continuing doubling the time that it's impacting neighbors, police are calling us, etc., and might be contra to nuisance ordinances that are on the books. There isn't any provisions for exemptions if the property's foreclosed on. Our banks didn't want to be a landlord, and here you've got a tenant that may have been there, didn't even know anything about the foreclosure, and now they have 60 days. Or bank, I don't know where that can go. I'm surprised banks aren't here talking about that. And then also it complicates FED negotiations. Now if tenants know they've got 60 days and they're not paying the rent, they can play a lot harder ball in the negotiations when we're in front of the judge talking about when they're going to give up possession. So to make the assumption that the mom and pop on the street, in the trench, property manager, landlord, whatever, is in agreement with these provisions, I think would be in error. And so I wanted to take my time to come down, and I really appreciate you giving me time to express my concerns regarding that one provision in this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Baker. I wanted to ask, have you been in contact with the Landlord-Tenant Coalition?
No.
And how many years have you been, you said, a general property manager?
I've been licensed since 1977. Been involved extensively in the realtor organization. There is no organized landlord organization in this general area, the Salem area. There used to be Multifamily Housing Council, but that's kind of gone by the wayside. My father started the Salem Apartment House Association with Walt Depew years ago, and so we've been very involved in landlord-tenant law. I've served on committees that helped craft the seller's property disclosure and the agency disclosure law, so I've been very involved. I think it's the obligation of a so-called coalition to disseminate information, to have folks provide input. When I brought up these points to the member in question, she said, gosh, we never even thought about that. And that's because it's probably not broad enough and probably not a lot of public comment. It's kind of like a closed little group. So I don't even know who's on the, other than that one person. In all my years, I have never known a person that's on this coalition. I don't even know where they meet or anything. So,
questions? Senator George.
Thank you for coming and testifying. I actually, in disclosure, own three or four single-family residences that we rent out. They're either on a piece of property that we own for farming or other things. And I thought the exact same thing. However, I assumed that the whole issue had been vetted. So the question for you is, I think you're probably right. I think probably what you've got is this coalition of people who have multifamily apartment complexes working with people who are in represent tenants, and I think people in single-family housing is slightly different. One of the things I just thought about is that, do you think the issue is solved by exempting, say, fourplexes or smaller, or do you think it also is something that actually affects people who are apartment complex owners? Apartment complex owners have a little more flexibility because they're dealing with so many more people, where it's much more difficult on single-family housing. When you sell an apartment complex, you're assuming that those people, you want to keep those people renting. But when you sell an individual house, it's very likely that you're selling to somebody who actually wants to occupy it. And so I can absolutely see what you're saying. So I'm thinking about, and fourplexes in a lot of times are the same thing, because some people will move into a fourplex and rent out the other three or a duplex. What's your view of kind of creating two pathways?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I agree. The chances of... And I own several single-family homes. I own no multifamily, and I don't want to belabor why. I have a philosophical reason for that. But one of the major reasons why I own single-family is to improve my market if I ever choose to sell. Because if you own a multifamily 20-unit, your only clients are other investors. When you own a single family, chances are greater than 50-50 that your ultimate purchaser is an owner-occupant. And so this is why this is a concern, is that that can interfere in a sale. When you're in a multifamily housing and you have a tenant on tenant, that isn't as much of an issue regarding nuisance. But when I'm talking about a nuisance of a single family, we're interrupting the peace and enjoyment of other owner occupants that are around the property, and that's of great concern because our family name is on the sign and we get the blame. And so we want to be able to resort, and that's why we don't do leases. We're all 30-day month to month, so that we can at least resolve our issues in 30 days, gets the police off our tail, and so that is a very important aspect, and that's why this has me great concern. So I would agree with you. There's a break in the financing between single family 1-4. That's where you can still get 30-year fixed rate financing, and 5 units and above. I would say that owners, rarely are we seeing owners buying a triplex or a fourplex to live in themselves. You certainly single family, and there's a good section of the rent, the housing stock where duplexes were built, designed for an owner occupant on one side and renting out the other side. So those would be the probably the highest chance of that occurring. Long answer for my short question. I'm guilty of that. Also, I'm sorry.
Okay, one more question. Sure, go ahead.
You mentioned the FED process,
yes,
which I'm unfamiliar with.
Yes.
Can you explain a little bit more about what you said as far as changing the negotiations during that process?
FED means forced entry and detainer, and if a tenant is not paying rent, you file paperwork, and about 9 days after you file, you get into court, and you go in front of a judge, and the judge looks, here, we want possession, or we're owed this rent, and the judge looks to the tenant, and at that point in time, the landlord can say, I only want possession. So in other words, it's a matter of negotiation of when the tenant's going to give up possession. And so if the tenant knows that now they have 60 days otherwise, and of course the judges are going to know this too, because they're going to know, they're going to ask now because it's the law, are you there a year or longer, the judge is going to look back on us and say, look, you want to go 2 weeks or 3 weeks, since this person's can stop you up for weeks and weeks on end because they've got a 60-day, I know that's not related to the payment, but it will enter into the negotiations and might essentially extend. And I want to point out one other thing that I think is a misconception. I would say most of our property owners have payments greater than the rent that they're getting from the tenants. I'll repeat that. Most of our property owners have rents that are not covering their own payment. And so when we're delayed out there, you're creating hardships on the folks that are providing the service of a home to somebody.
I did find something in my folder. It wasn't introduced, but I was visited by the Metro Multifamily Housing Association, and they gave me a piece of paper that says the Metro Multifamily Housing Association represents owners and property managers of 150,000 rental housing units in Oregon from the Portland metro area through the Willamette Valley. These members range from owners with single-family home rentals to larger property management companies. It's a leading source for data on rent levels, occupancy rates, and other housing issues. Legislative priorities include Senate Bill 771. Landlords and tenants have agreed to revisions to landlord-tenant law. This bill has been vetted by stakeholders and represents a balance of interests and concerns. So obviously that's an organization that represents owners and property managers throughout the valley from single-family to multifamily. So I think that there was, and we'll hear when we have this back up for another hearing, we'll hear testimony about who was around the table, but I just wanted to...
Can I respond to that, Madam Chair?
Sure.
That organization is predominantly major multifamily units. One reason why you join an organization such as that is due to the forms that might use that might apply, and since they are multifamily based, they really aren't very applicable to the way we do business, and so we have not joined them. We do get their newspaper, but nowhere in their newspaper has there been anything about Senate Bill 771 or any of the points that they were discussing, because this is part of, two very different groups, and they're negotiating here, and then they come up with this agreement to present to you, which is just fine, but it hasn't involved a substantial amount of the industry on the street. And it hasn't been, here's a proposal. I didn't know this was even coming down the pike. And I served on two working groups with the real estate agency on rules and things like that. I mean, it's not like I'm underground. So this caught me by surprise, and that's why I'm here.
Thank you. And we will be having another hearing after we get the amendment. Thank you.
Thank you so very much.
Oh, thank you. Closing the hearing on Senate Bill 771 and closing our committee for today. Thank you. What would I do without you, Lori?